I have a little collection of cartoons about clergy that I've acquired from here and there, mostly from people in the congregations I have served. I put a sample of them in as an insert in the order of service. This is just a few. And there's one I can no longer find, but I would like to describe it to you. It pictures two boys in a living room with the father of one of them in a clerical collar lurking at the doorway with a pad and pencil in hand. And one little boy is saying to the other, "It is my duty to inform you that you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used by my dad as a sermon illustration." Unlike many other professions, ministry is all-encompassing. It involves within the sphere of its definition everything from the mundane to the cosmic, from the intensely personal and internal to the communal and global, from the rarefied and academic to the simple and homey, from the analytical, rational, and scientific to the aesthetic, holistic, and mystical. Ministers are acutely aware that everything we do can in some way be used in our ministry. Reading a book or having a conversation, visiting an exhibit or seeing a film, observing a comet in the sky, or having an argument with a friend. All of these events of everyday living are potentially the stuff out of which one's ministry is molded. We ministers often bemoan the fact that we find it hard to separate our personal lives from our professional lives. I almost never read a book or an article without thinking, I can use this in a future sermon, in a newsletter column, with that seminar that I'm offering, in one-to-one counseling. Nothing we do as we move through our lives is irrelevant to ministry. And so ministry is essentially synonymous with living itself. As the author Aeneas Nin once said, the personal life deeply lived always expands into truths beyond itself. My struggles with myself lead me to understand the struggles with others. Well, this is as true for ministers as it is for writers. Although we ministers may sometimes regret the fuzziness of the line between the personal and the professional, most of us feel blessed to be in a profession that is so holistic, so fused with the totality of our lives. In my early years of ministry, when I was still in my mid-20s, people would look at me and exclaim, "You're too young to be a minister." I felt like answering as Leo Tolstoy did when he was appointed to a government post at a young age, "I mean no offense by my youth, and I am confident that definite progress is being made every day to correct it." Well, my youth has long since been corrected. But in retrospect, I now understand why people are hesitant about a very youthful minister. Because ministry is so bound up with life experience. Because becoming a minister is a process of lifelong learning. Because each new personal life crisis, each year one lives, enriches one's ministry. Perhaps a person can be a brilliant engineer or mathematician or biologist at 30. In fact, I've read that certain scientific and technical careers tend to peak early. But ministry needs time to mellow. This is not to say that you can't help a minister who is very young mellow into that role. There are some wise words on marriage by the 19th century Unitarian minister Theodore Parker, which I have often used in wedding ceremonies. He wrote, "It takes years to marry completely two hearts, even the most loving and well assorted. A happy wedlock is a long falling in love. Such a large and sweet fruit is marriage that it needs a long summer to ripen in, and then a long winter to mellow and season in. Like a good marriage relationship, one's ministry gets better and richer with the passage of time. And it also takes time for a new minister and the minister's congregation to work out the nature of their unique relationship. You will begin this new journey in about a year and a half when the search process is complete and the new minister arrives." Ministry is essentially a profession centered on relationship. Relationship to oneself, to one's congregation, to colleagues, to the larger community, and to the cosmos, the ultimate God, for those who use the term. It is a privilege, and it is very, very humbling to be invited into the deepest lives of others. A minister is asked to relate to people in a variety of ways, some of them quite intimate. In the role of pastor, the minister is called upon to be a counselor, a listener, a confidant. In the role of priest, by which I mean the sacramental ritual aspect of ministry, one is summoned to the scenes of some of life's most profound turning points to perform the religious community's rites of passage, birth, coming of age, marriage, and death. In the role of prophet, a minister is invited to be a social critic, a visionary, and a community leader, helping to actualize in the world the vision of a broader sense of justice and equality. In the role of preacher, the minister must relate to the needs of a varied congregation, offering words of insight and inspiration, solace, interpretation, commentary, and challenge. Another role of the minister, one which is less visible and is therefore often forgotten about, but which is vital to the life of a congregation, I will call preserver. You can tell that I love alliteration. So I call it preserver, in keeping with the roles of pastor, priest, prophet, and preacher. A minister preserves the life of a religious community in two ways: by serving as administrator along with other staff and with the board and committees to help keep the church running smoothly as an institution, and by preserving the particular traditions of the religious community. This means education via the pulpit, in seminars and groups, about our historical Unitarian and Universalist traditions. And it also means celebrating with the congregation the annual events and holidays and rituals that are important to the community. All of these roles, pastor, priest, prophet, preacher, and preserver, are facets of the minister's relational experience with those to whom she or he ministers. Paradoxically, however, the ministry is also a profession that involves aloneness and separation from others. Much of a minister's time is spent alone, brooding, reading, planning, writing and rewriting, struggling with questions of meaning, trying to call up creativity on schedule, living with confidences with which one has been entrusted, and also the multiplicity of roles and expectations tend to set a minister apart from the community to which he or she relates. Ordination itself is a symbolic rite of setting someone apart for a special purpose. As Unitarian Universalist minister Tom Owentoll put it some years ago, at a conference on ministerial renewal. In ministry, we know the anguish of persevering doubt, the feeling of powerlessness, the risk of misunderstanding and occasional rejection. In ministry, we have received misdirected flack and undeserved praise, both accentuating our separateness. In ministry, there are moments of unspeakable joy and unmentionable confession, both carried around unuttered. We know the loneliness of trying to create when empty, or sharing something born of sweat and anguish, and then having others nonchalantly evaluate the birth. Now, some of this feeling of separation is, of course, not exclusive to the ministry. It's really part of the human condition, something we all experience. And a feeling of separation has its positive side. It can be put to creative use. We can use our solitude to take stock, to renew ourselves, to reestablish a sense of connectedness with ourselves and the world. A critical, honest relationship with oneself is a must for effective ministry, as is a sense of relatedness to the cosmos, the spiritual or depth dimension of existence. But ministers are notorious for neglecting to take the time amid the weekly flurry of activities to use our solitude in positive ways. The result of the pressures of ministry, unrelieved by some sort of personal renewal, is the high rate of clergy burnout. 50% of people who enter the ministry drop out within the first 5 years. Ministry involves a healthy vacillation between solitude and community. A minister who pursues solitude in preference to community and study and meditation in preference to social interaction is in danger of losing touch with the needs of her religious community and is likely to miss the calls for help that sometimes come in subtle ways. Her ministry may become so intensely personal and idiosyncratic that honest one-to-one communication is lost. And a minister who is entirely wrapped up with the concerns of his parishioners, with the church institution, and with activism in the larger world, may lose touch with his own depths and with that which affords spiritual sustenance and renewal. His ministry may become shallow and fragmented. Good and sustaining ministry is born out of that creative tension between the sense of separation from and the feeling of identity and communion with the people one serves. So in the caretaking of your next minister, I would advise that you be sure that the minister not only acts in the world and is representing this congregation here and in the community and in the denomination, but that minister has some definite and complete time off when the only ministerial calls that may be made are for emergencies. The word minister comes from the Latin prefix minus, and the root word is minus. It's what it says. It means what it says. It's minor, lesser. The word minister was used historically to denote a servant, a person of lesser status than that of those that he or she serves. The servant was either one who served God as an ecclesiastic or one who served in the king's court. It seems odd when one considers this root meaning that religious ministers came to be thought of as lofty, revered, elevated, holy persons who are somewhere between humanity and God on the great chain of being. Actually, although in a sense the minister is a servant to the congregation, modern Unitarian Universalist ministry embraces neither the notion of a minister as a minor or lesser being, pardon me. This is a being with a bug. Let me catch that sentence again. Unitarian Universalist ministry embraces neither the notion of a minister as a lesser being, kind of a martyr on the loose, running around and trying desperately to fill everyone's needs at all times, not also a high and exalted authority figure who has a particular corner on the truth and a special connection with the divine. An idea of ministry much more appealing to most of us Unitarian Universalist ministers is that of a partnership of equals. There's a little reading here by a colleague of mine that speaks in metaphor about this partnership. He writes, "Ministry based on an equal relationship is like a dance. Sometimes I lead and you follow. Sometimes you lead and I follow. As we get to be better partners, it gets difficult to tell who exactly is leading and who is following. But by then, it doesn't matter. After all, it's the dance that's important." Although ministry is a partnership of equals, a minister does have a specialized role to fill. A former president of Star King School for the Ministry, the Reverend Gordon McKeeman, pointed to a line by the playwright Tennessee Williams as a description of ministry. He said, or Williams said, "To snatch the eternal from the desperately fleeting is the great magic trick of human existence." I would agree that that is the underlying task of ministry, and it does seem like magic when it is successful. To pull a more universal truth out of the individual personal grit of everyday life, to offer another some empathy, some lasting comfort, some broader perspective in the face of personal loss and tragedy, to envision and then speak for and work toward a more just and peaceful world, to help another who gropes toward religious meaning in a world in which nothing any longer seems sacred. These attempts to find and help others find enduring values and meanings that are larger than oneself and one's immediate concerns, these tries at snatching the eternal from the desperately fleeting, are what makes the ministry such an awesome, humbling, exciting, challenging, sometimes frustrating, and often rewarding occupation. There is one other aspect of ministry that I have discovered over the years to be necessary. This one is also embedded in the etymology of the word minister. The word minstrel comes from the same root as the word minister. But while minister came to refer to one holding a serious position in a governmental or an ecclesiastical office, minstrel became associated with a performer of musical ballads, a teller of jokes and tales, a kind of buffoon or king's fool type figure who relates truths through the comic spirit. Although ministry is often a serious pursuit that deals with life and death issues, it also has its lighter and more playful side. A minister is also a minstrel, using humor, laughter, and merrymaking to lighten the trudging footsteps of everyday existence, to remind us not to take ourselves too seriously, to illustrate a truth in the poignant way that the comic spirit can do, to recall us, if you will, to sanity. As you walk around the church today, you might find some of these, which are from, they've been left around the church, I discovered last night, by the faithful fools who spoke here last week. And I thought, this is appropriate. Sometimes this is a minister. Well, if you'll bear with me for one more dip into the etymology of a word, there's that now somewhat archaic word, parson, used to refer to a minister. Parson, etymologically, is simply a variant on the word person. It comes from the old French persona, which in turn derives from the Latin persona. Before the 11th century, the words parson and person were used interchangeably. Etymologists aren't sure why parson eventually came to be used to refer only to clergy. It may come from the reference to the person on deeds who legally hold the church property, called the parson in that context. But I like the implication embedded in the original meaning of the word. The parson, the minister, is above all a person, one who, like all persons, has unique gifts and talents as well as shortcomings, who has both personal strengths and weaknesses, one who laughs and cries, loves and grieves, enjoys personal triumphs, and endures and can learn from personal failures. If you can bear this essential personhood in mind as you form your new relationship with your new settled minister, there is the potential that many rich and rewarding relationships, parson to person, person to person, will emerge. Today, with the selection of a ministerial search committee, you as a congregation launch the long search process for a new settled minister. May that search bear fruit, and may the relationship between minister and congregation that is the result of this search be a long and mutually fulfilling one.